history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there still are heroic stories to be told, and often they're hidden in plain sight. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take this journey together each time, we learn a lot. Yes, we're educated, we're entertained. Ultimately, we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If we're open to it, these memories can have an impact on our latest generations. Typically, we spend most of our time discussing things that happened more than 70 years ago. But today, we're going to start with something that happened just this week. You may have heard the news. The aircraft carrier USS Lexington was discovered this week 2 miles deep on the floor of the Coral Sea, nearly 76 years after that historic ship was sunk during World War II. You may recall that 6 months ago, the USS Indianapolis was discovered by the research vessel Petrel, funded by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. His father served in World War II, and Allen has devoted much effort and expense toward preserving military history through several different avenues. Finding the Indianapolis was kind of a needle in a haystack, and in the case of the Lexington, the Navy knew where she went down on May 8th of 1942, and she went way, way, way down, 2 miles deep, where that discovery was made this week. As soon as I heard the news, my thoughts turned to Gordon Scott, a survivor of the Lexington who shared his story on this program about 4 years ago. Gordon, who grew up in Kingsburg, California, and spent some of his later years on the Monterey Peninsula, where he was instrumental in founding the famed Poppy Hills Golf Course 3 decades ago, resides now at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno, where I had the privilege of being the first to show him the video and still images of the Lexington and his ship's final resting place. We'll get more of Gordon's World War II experiences on the Lexington in a moment, but the first thing I had to ask was, did it ever occur to him over the last 3/4 of a century since he abandoned that sinking ship that the wreckage of the Lexington might ever be found?
No, it's unbelievable. The Navy knew at the proximity of where the ship was sunk, but it's still unbelievable to find it.
And they went to great expense and great effort to find that ship, to see those images from 2 miles deep in the Coral Sea, to see the guns and the airplanes. And what does that bring to mind for you?
Well, when I heard the news, I absolutely couldn't believe it. This Paul Allen that's funded this deal for doing this is unbelievable. I don't know about the Indianapolis, but that has to be even more remarkable to find it than the Lexington was. But we started at 11-something in the morning, never abandoned ship till 5:18 that evening, and we're down. Some guys got lucky and got right on board another ship. Others were picked up by different destroyers and transferred to cruisers. It's been a long time ago.
Can you help us understand the feeling you get or the emotion of looking at that video or those photos and seeing that name, Lexington, inscribed on the metal 2 miles deep?
No, I just can't. It's just unbelievable that they were able to do this. And most of the memories you forgot, but this brings back a lot of them. And I'd like to thank you, Paul, for bringing this and showing me the pictures of this. It's just unbelievable.
I imagine there'll probably be more to come as they continue to explore that area with the greatest respect for those who are still on the ship. And I know you're here. You're one of the survivors. You had a crew of close to 2,800 on that ship, and there were a little more than 200 who died. But do you think this holds significance for those families of those who died? And just for you as someone who may have known some of those gentlemen who died, do you think this is a way to honor them to have found this wreck and have an idea of where their final resting place is?
Well, it probably means more to their families than it does to the individuals. I'll be 96 in just a few months, and so there isn't very many left of us. In fact, I really don't know who's left, but it has to mean a lot to the families to see this and remember this.
Well, and it gives people an excuse to talk about your ship again, and your ship was significant in World War II. And I know we've talked about this before. We put a whole hour on the radio about it. But when you think about the Lexington and its legacy or its significance,
What comes to mind for you?
This happens to be a deal I had written down here. The Lex was at sea 113 days since December the 7th until it was sunk. They had 4,900 landings between December the 7th and May the 8th and traveled 43,311 miles between December 7th and the 8th. Total crew was 2,934. This is just a few of the deals that I've written down in the past. The Battle of Bougainville was February the 20th, 1942. Was the first battle for the Lexington and the fighter group. Then they went to Salamalua. Now it's unbelievable. May the 8th, 1942. Abandoned ship at 5:18 that evening.
Is it hard at all? Is it difficult to look at those images?
No, it isn't. Brings back a lot of memories, but it's not difficult to watch them. And it's just unbelievable that they were able to do this. And I'm sure, like I said, it means a lot to the families because most of the people are gone.
Most of the 2,770 who survived the Lexington sinking are gone, and their families have been moved by this discovery. That includes the man commanding the entire U.S. Pacific Command, Admiral Harry B. Harris, Jr. As the son of a survivor of the USS Lexington, Admiral Harris said this week, I offer my congratulations to Paul Allen and the expedition crew of Research Vessel Petrel for locating the Lady Lex sunk nearly 76 years ago at the Battle of Coral Sea. We honor the valor and sacrifice of the Lady Lex's sailors, all those Americans who fought in World War II, by continuing to secure the freedoms they won for all of us. Well, he knows how to say it. I haven't heard a speech yet that Admiral Harris didn't nail. And the reality is, the man who commands all of our American forces in the Pacific would have never been born if his father hadn't survived the sinking of that carrier. And we have a dwindling number of sailors who can tell the Lexington story, so let's hear about it through the memories of Gordon Scott. He enlisted in the Navy on his 18th birthday in July 1940, having no idea that America would be at war a year and a half later.
No, I didn't. When I first got in the Navy, I went to San Diego Naval Training Station and was there in training program for 3 months. For a while, I thought I might have been in the Army. We'd done so much drilling. But they do teach you a lot of things, and not only drilling and marching and various things like that, but they had various schools like firefighting school, and I didn't realize how important the firefighting school was for the Navy. Our ship eventually burned up. So it was quite a deal there.
What was your first impression of the Lexington? When did you go aboard that ship?
When I got through after 3 months in Naval Training Station San Diego, was sent to Long Beach and got on a destroyer and sent to Long Beach and was stationed on the USS Arizona. I left from Long Beach and went to Bremerton, Washington Naval Shipyard there. And the Lexington was in there, and after about a month on the USS Arizona, I was transferred to the Lexington, which was very fortunate from what happened to the Arizona.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, whoa, I've heard of that ship. Maybe I've visited what's left of that ship as it still sits there in Pearl Harbor with those teardrops of oil bubbling to the surface. Did you know a lot of those who are still on the Arizona?
Well, I didn't know that many. After all, I was only aboard Arizona for about a month. But then I went on the Lexington. I did get to know a few people, and I've never found out what's happened to him. But the Lexington, I got aboard the Lexington and was stationed in what they call V1 Division, which had the after flight deck deal on the carrier. We were there for about a month and left from there and went back to Long Beach. And from there we went from Long Beach to Pearl Harbor.
And this is all still before anything has happened war-wise. America is not at war. Were there any rumblings that you guys were preparing for something like that?
No, we had done nothing but training was in and out of Pearl Harbor and flight quarters and training both our crew and the pilots too. We didn't hear anything about war till the national emergency started. There when we'd go to sea, even after before we were in the war, we'd go to sea and it was just blackout at night and the lights and everything. So they were looking for something, but we really didn't know about anything.
And we've heard a lot over the years about December 7th and what Pearl Harbor was like that day from different vantage points. Maybe you can give us a sense of what it was like around there before all this happened. Was it almost like an adventure for you to be out in that part of the world?
At that time, you didn't realize it was quite a resort deal like it is today. But and we were away from home, so It wasn't as luxurious as we thought it might be, but it is a great place.
And I mentioned that date, December 7th, and you might have been there December 7th, but the Lexington shipped out the day before?
Yes, we were anchored just on the left side of Ford Island, which is a Naval Air Station in Pearl Harbor. And we left out on our way to Midway with a load of Marine planes to reinforce Midway. When we heard about the war, or they bombed Pearl Harbor, we turned around and tried to intercept them, and we couldn't find them, and probably very lucky we didn't, because we didn't have a big fleet with us. The original Lexington had 5-inch guns, 4 batteries of 5-inch guns, and 4 turrets. It had originally been built for a battle cruiser. Right after the war started, we went back into the naval shipyard there and took the turrets off and got rid of the 5-inch guns, and they put all in anti-aircraft guns, because that was what it's going to be all about, fighting planes.
And you mentioned when the war started, but I imagine that's a pretty significant memory for you, how you found out you're aboard the Lexington and you just left Pearl Harbor yesterday and now they're bombing Pearl Harbor. How did that news come to your ship?
Well, of course, it was transmitted by radio to the ship, and they announced it on the loudspeaker and sounded general quarters. From there, they had bringing up all the ammunition and everything for all the gun turrets and the 5-inch guns and whatever. We tried to find the Japanese fleet, but it was very fortunate we didn't, because they probably could have blown us out of the water. So we steamed around and never did find where they came from or anything, and we turned around after 3 or 4 days, came back into Pearl Harbor, and it was just, we just couldn't believe it. The USS Utah, which is an old battleship that had retired and they were just using it for training purposes, had taken our berth on Ford Island, and you don't hear anything about the USS Utah, but it's still underwater alongside Ford Island right now. They literally blew it up and had thought that we would be there. They knew every ship that was there. The only mistake I think the Japanese made, right above at the Pearl City there, up on the hill was Red Hill. All of the fuel for all of the ships and everything were in big tanks there. If they'd have bombed those, we would have had to come clear back to the mainland United States. They didn't touch him. That was a big mistake they made.
Yeah, and a big what if. And you've got a few of those. What if you had remained on the Arizona? You wouldn't be here. And as you said, the Utah, which along with the Arizona, the Oklahoma, was taken out that day, it was in your spot. So that's another what if you had still been there?
That's right. Yeah, couldn't believe it. The Utah is still underwater there. They never have done anything about it.
And I want to discuss a little more of that scene that you saw when you sailed back into Pearl, but you mentioned going to general quarters on your ship, the Lexington. What did that mean for you personally? What was your duty station at that point?
We were up on the flight deck, and of course, we didn't launch any planes. We were scouting around trying to find the Japanese fleet, too. And we had search planes up, landed them back aboard, but we just couldn't believe it.
And when you did roll back into Pearl, and you mentioned the Utah being in your spot, but most of us weren't there, and maybe we've seen some grainy film or we've seen some black and white photos, but you saw it in living color that day. What did you see, and what did it do to you?
We just couldn't believe it. It was almost sick. Oil on the water and the ships, they weren't burning then, but, I mean, sunk. The battleship, there's what we call Battleship Row on one side of the island, was the opposite side where the carriers used to anchor, which was very, very fortunate. The whole time I was in there, from when I first got to Hawaii in Pearl Harbor, I don't believe I ever seen that there wasn't a carrier in port. And it's really amazing that the Saratoga at that point was back in the mainland in the United States. And I keep referring to the United States because Hawaii wasn't in the United States at that time. It just was unbelievable to see the destruction. The ships underwater and everything, and I forget how long it took. We refueled, reprovisioned, and we left out of there, and we never came back 90 days at sea without touching port, and we never did find the Japanese.
Well, you guys would have a pretty impressive encounter with them in late February, but I want to get a taste for what it was like aboard the Lexington, because we've maybe seen the posters with the tattered flag and Remember Pearl Harbor, or we've seen, of course, the legendary song Remember Pearl Harbor. But is it too melodramatic to say that was a rallying cry aboard your ship? What was the impact on morale, on motivation, on what that did for you guys to have seen that devastation and to know that now your country is at war?
First of all, it was hard to believe. Even though we had been training for war, really, and all the time prior to December the 7th, we'd be in and out of Pearl Harbor. We'd alternate with ships. Between the three main deals, the Enterprise and the Yorktown and the Lexington, there was always someone in port. It wasn't a coincidence that no ship or carriers were in there. All the battleships were. But it was just kind of hard for us to believe. And the devastation was just unbelievable.
How did that leave you guys feeling about the future or about the Japanese or about the task that you had at hand now?
We knew that's what we were there for. We were all over the Pacific trying to find the Japanese fleet or whatever, maybe trying to make them think we had more than we did, but I'm sure that they knew we didn't have more. Then on February the 20th, we were going to try to make a strike on the Japanese in Rabaul. And Rabaul is quite a bit above the Guadalcanal, east side of Guadalcanal, further up in there. And we were going in there and try to bomb them in Rabaul. On the 20th, they spotted us, or one of their planes spotted us. There was nine Mitsubishi 97, which is called Bettys, that came out and attacked us. They got to the dropping point, and the captain of the ship had somebody with binoculars, and was supposed to let them know when they seen the bombs drop. And he swung the ship around, and it just thudded around the stern of the ship and missed the ship.
Where were you while that was going on? What were you supposed to be doing?
Well, at that point, we'd launched our planes, and we were waiting for some of our planes to come back in. Like I said, we had charge of the resting gear in the after part of the ship. This is the barrier cables and cross-deck pennants that go across the ship that the planes catch with the hook of their deal and stop the planes from crashing. So we were just waiting for our planes to come back, and our planes then were chasing the first wave of nine. When they were chasing them, here come another wave of nine, and we had Lieutenant Butch O'Hara and another fellow that was in above the ship. The other fellow's guns jammed, and when they were chasing these planes away, that was a wave of nine, and he shot five of those down. We turned around and got out of there because we were up, and Rabaul was quite deep in Japanese territory at that time.
I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to be you. So your job is, when these planes are going to land, to make sure that tail hook catches the cable and they don't go careening off the deck. But it's probably a pretty helpless feeling while you're waiting for those planes to come in and just watching this battle rage in the sky. I mean, could you guys see the bombers and see O'Hare and the fighters?
We could see them when they first came over and dropped the bombs. We could see them coming down. But when O'Hara and the other fellows actually chasing them, they were out of sight.
So what did you guys do while that was going on? I mean, I'm trying to imagine what you could do. You have to be pretty concerned about your ship's future here.
We probably were a little scared, really. I mean, we were up in their territory quite a bit, and here twin-engine bombers coming out after us. And like I say, we turned around and hauled out of there. It's kind of a helpless feeling when you are attacked. There's not much you can do. I mean, our duties there was in the after deck of the planes that would be landing and the resting gear. Oh, we had trained on the guns at different times and everything, but they had all those manned from the gunnery department and everything.
And it's not like you can do anything about it. You can't take cover anywhere. You've got to stay there on the deck ready to do your job, right?
That's right. There's not much you can do. And it's really a kind of a helpless feeling.
You mentioned them chasing those bombers, and they're flying F-4Fs at the time?
F-4Fs. Actually, F-4Fs was like a bumblebee. They were a very short wingspan, not much in length. They had so much torque that when they would take off down the deck, they would just move sideways. The change in aviation from the planes that we had then and what got later and then even throughout later in the war, too, were just unbelievable.
There was quite an advancement over time, and of course that's even more pronounced now, 76 years after the Lexington sank in the Coral Sea. One of the photos sent back by Paul Allen's RV Petrel crew shows one of those bumblebee-like F-4F fighters resting 2 miles below the surface. You can check that out at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll hear about the day that ship sank from Gordon Scott when we come right back after this.
Remember when the
bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a chance today in light of this week's news that the wreckage of the USS Lexington has been found at the bottom of the Coral Sea, to hear from one of the last remaining survivors of the Lady Lex, Gordon Scott, at age 95, now enjoying life at the Veterans Home of California in Fresno. In a bit, I'm going to ask him a few what-if questions in light of that discovery by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen and his research vessel Petrel team. But when we left off, you were hearing from Gordon about that carrier's most famous fighter pilot and his legendary exploits that essentially saved the ship. Chicago's biggest airport is named after Butch O'Hare, and if you're ever there, you'll notice an F-4F Wildcat fighter plane on display, just like the one O'Hare earned a Medal of Honor in on February 20th, 1942, when he weaved his way in and out of Japanese bombers, shooting down five of them in just a couple of hours. He took just one bullet hole in his Wildcat, and O'Hare would expend all the ammunition he had. When he came back to the ship, he was mistakenly fired upon by one of the Lexington's anti-aircraft guns, like the ones you can see covered in barnacles in those images beamed back by Paul Allen's research team. For Gordon Scott and the rest of the men on the Lexington that day, what O'Hare did in the air above the ship was quite a feat.
It certainly was. When he came back aboard and landed and everything, it just unbelievable. And I'm sure he couldn't believe what he had done either.
Were you part of securing his plane when it landed?
Well, like I say, I was in V1 division, which was in the resting gear in the back. When the planes land there, they have a tail hook at the back of the plane. The resting gear cables are hydraulically controlled, and they raise up to about 10 inches. If they miss one of them, they go into barriers and crash. There's a landing signal officer in the back on the port side in the back that helps them come in and gives them the directions, whether too high or too low or whatever, and then he gives the deal to cut. Reciprocal engines before the jet engines, when a plane came in, they had to come in and fly in speed, and then when they tried to land, they actually had to cut power. And if they didn't make the deal and whatever, they'd crash. On a jet plane today, when they come in, they land and hit the throttle full speed, and if they miss, they can take off and go back around. But the carrier decks now are slanted instead of straight away like they used to be.
You mentioned O'Hare coming back, and it was unbelievable. Was there some celebration on the ship?
Yes, there was. I don't think he realized what he had done either. There was a lot of celebration because it was quite a feat, and it was early in the war, too.
He was the first Navy pilot to become an ace and then the first to win a Medal of Honor, and he won it for that day.
That's right, and he was then brought back to the United States and, I shouldn't say paraded around, but went around with the morale for the people back here, what had happened and everything, and selling more war bonds and so forth. But it was the same kind of a deal that they brought back the people that raised the flag at Iwo Jima, brought all those boys back home too.
And how did that play on the ship? I imagine some guys might say, hey, that guy just kind of saved our ship by shooting down five Japanese bombers. We need that guy. Keep him here.
Yeah, that's right. He came back later as a skipper of a fighter squadron.
Yes, he did. He was in charge of all the different planes flying off the carrier USS Enterprise, and on a night fighter mission in an F-6F Hellcat on November 26, 1943, O'Hare was shot down. His body was never found. His plane was never found. Before the end of the war, the Navy had named a destroyer for him, and Butch O'Hare remains one of the more well-known of the more than 405,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II.
And I bring that up with you, Gordon, because you and all the other veterans I interview always tell me that the real heroes of World War II are those that never came home. Butch O'Hare, of course, one of those. And what impression did he make on you during your time together on the Lexington?
I didn't have a lot to do with him, but he was a very humble person. I mean, it wasn't a guy that, you know, blowing that he had done this and everything. It was an unbelievable feat.
Yes, sir, without question. You know, I have some links to more information on Butch O'Hare if you visit hometownheroesradio.com. But let's get back to your story, Gordon. What was next for you and the Lady Lex?
Well, from there, we got back in and back to Pearl Harbor. And I think it was somewhere about 113 days or something like that that we'd been at sea. And we came back in and refueled and went back to sea. We didn't realize it at the time, but in March, when we attacked at Solomalu and Leia in New Guinea, that was on the west side of New Guinea, and we went around to the eastern side, and there was a pass in the mountains there that was the planes that we had then, the service ceiling, which you could actually wouldn't go above that, or would be pretty hard to go above it, could go through this pass, and they went through and bombed the ships, and they sank several of their ships, and probably stopped. In fact, Australia never forgot it. I mean, I thought that would have been a stepping stone of invading Australia. At one of the reunions we had in the Lex, one of the last ones, they even sent a representative from Australia thanking us. I mean, it was quite unbelievable. But that was stopping the Japanese from really getting into Australia. They had to fly through this pass in New Guinea and then bomb them and then get back before the cloud formations closed the pass off. So it was pretty well timed.
A couple months later, you guys would be looking for someone to save you. What do you remember about May 7th, 1942, and the day that followed?
Some of our scout planes sighted the Japanese fleet and carriers and cruisers, battleships, and everything. We sent planes and attacked them and sank one carrier and damaged another one. And then the next day, our planes were going back, going to attack them again. They had spotted us in the meantime. In mid-flight, here was a fleet from their carriers coming back to attack us. And they passed each other going, we're going to attack them and they're coming to attack us. Well, they got to us about 11 o'clock in the morning. They came in with dive bombers and torpedo planes. We took one torpedo hit on the port side and took two bomb hits, one in the superstructure on the starboard side and another bomb hit on one of the gun stations on the port side. There was a lot of damage, but our planes came back, and we had never had over an 8-degree list on the ship, and we landed, got back into the wind to land our planes that were coming back from attacking them, and landed our planes back. Didn't land all of them, but we landed the ones that were there. Then they were refueling our planes to go back for another attack, and apparently it had ruptured some gasoline lines internally in the ship and was spewing gas out. That's very high octane gas, and it started burning up inside. And indirectly, the Japanese didn't sink us from their bomb hits or torpedo hits, but our ship burned up. That was at 11 something in the morning, and we didn't abandon ship till 5:18 that night.
And you're describing that, and I'm thinking, what did that look like? What did that feel like? And as you described, you still had to land your plane, so you're still there at your duty station, and your ship is damaged and on fire. Let's start here, maybe. Can you help us understand what that felt like when the torpedo and those bombs hit the Lexington?
I was about what we call the barrier cables that stop the planes if they're going to crash. Needless to say, people say they're not scared. I think they're damn liars. But was back right by the superstructure, and when we were attacked, pretty good jolt when you get a torpedo hit and a bomb hit, or one of the bomb hits in the superstructure right above us where we were. And I don't know, it's quite a feeling. It's hard to explain, really. We would send crews down fighting the fire internally. In the Navy, from when the ship was first built, I think they painted every week for an inspection. And I don't know how thick the paint was on the metal between and all the compartments, but they had doors that you could what call them, dog them down with latches on them and close them like locking a door in a house. It would get so hot on one side, would start paint burning on the other side. So literally that just went from compartment to compartment and dogging them down, burning, crews going down. Then people more and more began coming up on the flight deck. We had a little over probably 2,000 people aboard the ship.
I don't know if there wasn't 2,000 up there, because there were still people going down and fighting the deal and just waiting. I mean, a period of waiting, that was from 11 to 5 o'clock that night, just laying there, just ship burning up internally. People would get a little scared, and they'd take life rafts, rubber life rafts that were in the planes, and inflate them, throw them over the side, and there's quite a bit of current in the ocean, and these life rafts would just float away. One of the deals that I think it was, if I remember right, it was probably 5:18 that night when they told us to abandon ship. I'll never forget it. There was a destroyer that came alongside, and I went down. I was in the water and got picked up by the destroyer. I looked up, and here was a guy that was one of the squadron. We called him Porky Pref. He was in the torpedo squadron. Had inflated a big three-man or five-man life raft, and he tied a line to his wrist and another one to the raft and had some guys throw it over the side. Well, I was down on the destroyer, just got picked up, and I looked up, and here he come. He forgot how far it was to the water, and that the raft got down to the water before he did. And I never seen the guy again for several years.
So you weren't in the water all that long? You got picked up quickly?
Got picked up and was later transferred to a cruiser, the USS Portland, transferred to a cruiser. And we were black from smoke and kind of sick and scared and everything else. And it was then starting to get dark, and we just laid down in one of the compartments of the ship. And cruisers have a couple seaplanes that they send up in scouting for the cruisers. That morning they shot one off, and we thought, my God, here we go again, someone's bombing the ship. But they had just shot one of the cruiser planes off.
So the Lexington went down there in May of 1942, and obviously you survived, and a lot were able to get off. You talked about the abandoned ship. When did you realize how many fellow sailors you lost that day?
We ended up in the Tonga Islands. We were in Tonga Tabu in the Tonga group. Tonga is several different islands. When we were there, well, there was a hospital ship there. A lot of our people were injured, went there, and several of them even died afterwards on the hospital ship. And a lot of people had to stay there. The rest of us were put on a transport that was in Tonga. We stopped back at Pearl Harbor and picked up some Marines that had been going back to the U.S. We came back to San Diego. We pulled in what they call a destroyer base. It's in the south from downtown San Diego, way back in the destroyer base. That was in late afternoon, and they announced that anybody that had families in San Diego could go ashore that night. Well, I had a brother that was a foreman in one of the aircraft plants in San Diego, so I got to go ashore, and went down to the aircraft plant there, and he worked on a late night shift, went up to the security there and told him who I was, and I was dungarees and no uniform, and the guy kind of looked at me suspiciously, and he radioed in or called in on the phone and got a hold of my brother, and he came out, and he couldn't believe it. He says, "Did you desert the Navy?" We weren't supposed to tell anybody, but I had to tell him what happened, and we got back, and later they issued us clothing and everything the next day and got us all straightened out. Got to come back home to Kingsburg and hadn't said anything. I was walking down the streets here in Kingsburg when it came back and out in the news, and there was a fellow here from the Kingsburg Recorder newspaper that hunted me down and wanted to know what happened.
Your ship's been sunk. Your brother doesn't know about it. Nobody knows about it. But here all of a sudden you are, and they're wondering why. That had to be a pretty surreal kind of stretch of time there.
Yeah, it was. It was quite a deal. But I was fortunate. I got to come back to Kingsburg for a short time. Went back to San Diego after about 3 or 4 weeks. There's six of us. They divided us up in different sections. At first they tried to see if we couldn't get another carrier that was being built or about ready to get out of building. And rename it the Lexington and put the whole crew on it, but they couldn't do that. So they divided our V1 division, which was the resting gear on the carrier, and they sent six of us to the Naval Air Station and shipyards in Philadelphia. And they were just starting a training school there. They were building so many Jeep carriers and other carriers at that time, they didn't have people trained really to man the deals. So they were setting up a deal, and they used the six of us for a while there in the training program to set it up. And then after about possibly a month, we were transferred to Norfolk, Virginia, the naval base there, went aboard another carrier, the USS Sewanee. And after a short time, we went out to sea and a group of new pilots qualifying. Some of them hadn't been landing on carriers. That was an experience, too, because there was a lot of accidents. And then after maybe a week or two, we got left out of there and went to Bermuda. Then we done the same thing. We came out of Bermuda and trained more pilots, landing more. We had a catapult on this carrier, launching planes and landing them back and training everybody on the ship. And might say that basically, by and large, the biggest percentage of the personnel on the ship had never been to sea before. We had one experience to show the lack of training. They had a plane hooked up on a catapult, and we were going to sea, and it sounded flight quarters. And this plane, normally you would never hook a plane up on the catapult. You put what they call a bridle up on the plane and attach it to the catapult. And this was all hooked up there. And I was there talking to one of the guys that was with us, leaning against the plane and turning and went to the bridge just to get adjacent to us. And I heard a click and I turned around and here this plane had been fired off of the catapult and mowing people down, going down the deal. No one in the plane, and the plane wasn't turning up, and it was terrible. This friend of mine that had been there, the plane just run right over him. He'd hurt his back real bad, and he was in the hospital for a long time and killed quite a few people and maimed a lot of people. And it was a terrible accident.
Again, I'm struck by something you said there. You said you had just walked away right before. If you had still been standing where you were, what would have happened to you?
That's right. I mean, I've been very lucky. And still am.
And we're blessed to have the opportunity to visit with Gordon Scott, one of our last living connections to that ship discovered this week at the bottom of the Coral Sea. More from Gordon when we come back, including what belongings of his are still on the USS Lexington way down there under the ocean. Check out the photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and some of the history brought to life this week thanks to the discovery of the USS Lexington, 2 miles below the spot in the Coral Sea where it was sunk in May of 1942. Before we're done, I'm going to ask 95-year-old Gordon Scott about what he would look for if he could go back and explore his old ship. But one important distinction about the crew of the Lexington, unlike the cruiser Indianapolis, for instance, the last World War II ship that Paul Allen's RV Petrol team discovered last year, the men on the Lexington had the rest of the war to endure. The Indianapolis tragedy unfolded right before the end of World War II, while the Battle of the Coral Sea, in which the Lexington was sunk, was one of the first major naval engagements of the war. Gordon Scott had gone in before the war started. He remained in uniform until after it all ended. And 6 months after the Lexington sank, he was participating in the invasion of North Africa aboard the escort carrier USS Sewanee.
I have never seen so many ships in my life. There was transports with crews. There was some destroyers that had been old destroyers, what we call four-stackers, that had been converted, loaded with Marines to take them in close and land them. And ships of every caliber, I mean from battleships to carriers to cruisers to destroyers and transports loaded with men. And I just couldn't believe it. I mean, it was a number of ships. The only trouble we had in North Africa wasn't from aircraft or anything, but submarines. The Germans had a lot of submarines, and there was a lot of fishing boats that were still out in the water, and they even threatened some of them to blow them out or get out of there, because they were radioing, I think, some of these submarines, and they sank several submarines when they were there, but none of the ships were hit, but were never attacked by any aircraft or anything. But an invasion there was a French port. In the Vichy French there, they had Jean Bart, I think was a battleship that the French had, was in there, And we sent planes in and were bombing those, but they couldn't bomb any of the ships in there. They didn't want to touch any of the French ships. So it was quite a diplomatic deal. I mean, a diplomatic war. But anyway, that was probably the first invasion they started from Casablanca into Italy. And
so what happened to you the rest of the war? Because we're only about halfway through your 6 years in the Navy.
Left there, came back to Norfolk, Virginia, and after refueling and reprovisioning and getting planes and stuff back aboard, we took off and we didn't know again where we were going. And we finally got out and we went through the Panama Canal. And we went through the Panama Canal at Christmas. Got through the Panama Canal and back out to the Pacific. We headed for the South Pacific, and we landed at Niumea, New Caledonia. It was a big bay that we'd anchored in there. And the captain wanted to get some flight time in. I was in the air department there. I don't know how he asked me, but he asked me if I wanted to go up with him in one of the seaplanes that we had. He had a hard time getting it off of the water. Had to bounce it a little because there wasn't too much wind. And he finally got it up and flying out around their New Caledonia there in Niumea. He got up there and he radioed back and says, "It's all yours," laid back like that. And I flew the thing around for a while, and I kept the darn island in sight because I'd get lost if I'd got out in the ocean. But we came back in and landed and hoisted the plane back. I think it was what we called a seaplane called a J2F that was a combination of a seaplane, and it also had wheels that could let down and land on regular runways too. We landed and brought that back aboard. We kept that down in the hangar deck, and they used it just for utility purposes and fly back and forth in some of the islands there.
Let me ask you real quick, because I was watching your facial expressions as you told that story, and you shared early on that you got into the Navy because you wanted to fly, and you had that dream of being a pilot. And now, thanks to his invitation there and his letting off the controls, you had that chance to fly that plane during World War II. What kind of excitement was that for you?
Like I said, I kept the island pretty much in sight. It wasn't probably just a straight line flight. I probably headed up and down and in and out a little, but was able to straighten it out after a while, and he slept a while and finally came back when we landed back.
Is it an exaggeration for me to say it was a bit of a dream come true for you?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I never thought of it, but it was quite a deal at that time. I kept trying to get transferred and figured I had a better chance if I could get off of there to get maybe go to flight school or something. Finally, I got a deal that if I could get off of the ship was going to get underway the next day. They had a list. They were going to transfer some people off. And in the meantime, I had advanced my rank, and I was a chief petty officer at the time. And they told me if I could get off before the ship got underway the next day with the party to go to this transport, I got transferred back off and sent back. Got back to San Francisco, got 30 days leave, and got married. Yeah, was shipped to Corpus Christi, Texas, and I was stationed at the Naval Air Station in Corpus Christi, Texas, where they trained a lot of planes. But in the meantime, I'd got married and wasn't too interested in going to flight school then. Was in Corpus Christi, Texas, and I got stationed in what they call an O&R or A&R. It was assembly and repair. They'd bring a plane in one end of the building and take the engine out and disassemble the engine. They had engine department disassemble, and then the deal and goes in and rebuild the whole engine. Got a new engine, put it out the front door, and the plane going through and rebuilding the plane. So you're putting new, like, it was actually a factory. We had both civil service personnel working there and naval personnel. And it was kind of a tough deal because a lot of the people that had been as civilians there that got drafted, and then when they looked at their MO or whatever they deal, they found out they were there and they put them back in there with a lot less pay. But anyway, I was there late 44. I got back to the States and went there, and then in 46, I got my discharge papers and came back.
So were you in Corpus Christi then when the war ended?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was in Corpus Christi till July of 1946.
What was that like there when that news hit where you were that this is over? You were in at the beginning of it back in December of 41, and now it's finally come to an end, and you're on the right side, the side that won.
Well, it was quite an experience, and exhilaration was just was glad it was over for the poor people that didn't make it home.
Would you say you were kind of relieved? Did you feel like you could get on with your life now that this was over?
I had an opportunity originally. I thought at the one time I would stay in the Navy, and then I had an opportunity to, my father-in-law was in business here, and he offered his son and me, his son was a naval pilot that went in after again with college, and his other brother was a Marine pilot, both of them killed, by the way. Anyway, was offered an opportunity to go in business here, and we opened up an auto parts store here in Kingsburg, and I was here 43 years and built it from scratch. My other brother-in-law that went in with me, he went back in the service and was killed during the Korean War, or the Vietnamese War, rather. I was very fortunate here. I had a good business, and eventually I turned it over to my son-in-law and my daughter, and I retired in Pebble Beach, California.
Played a lot of golf, a couple holes in one, I know you remember. And speaking of remember, I'm just listening to this, and you talk about your brothers-in-law who were killed in the war. And, of course, there were those lost on the Lexington. And you had the opportunity to go there to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight to see the World War II Memorial and to look at that wall of gold stars representing all 405,000 killed in World War II. What was that experience like for you? Did you think about those guys I just mentioned?
Paul, I sure did. I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is. And to go back there, I'd been to Washington, D.C. with my family one time, but never like this. And to see the wall and the names of the deal, and it's just unbelievable. And I just can't say enough for what you've done on the Honor Flight. And Al Perry and his crew there and the chaperones that were there were just tremendous. And there was a lot of people in wheelchairs. We had a lot of rain and everything. And yet they rolled with the punches, and it was just unbelievable. And then to come back with the people in Fresno, with the people from Lemoore Naval Air Station there standing in their dresser whites, saluting there as you came through the deal, it was just, I thought the whole Navy was there. And I tell you, it's one of the greatest things that I have ever seen. And if I can ever do it, and I've talked to Al, if I can ever help in any way, I think I told you earlier about letters that they sent, they had mail call.
And did you know that was coming when you were on the plane back?
No, I didn't. That was, it just was unbelievable. And I was clear in the back of the plane when I got that packet and opened it, and I really didn't read all of them. But then when I got home and got to reading them, there was two kids here from the Herndon Barstow School in the sixth grade that put their name and address down in the class they were in and asked if I would write them and let them know what we'd done and everything. I was so impressed, I went by and seen them. And they brought them into the main office, and I was just thrilled to see these two young children. And there's one other one there that wasn't there that day that I'm going to go by after school starts and see him. But it was wonderful.
I want to say thank you for serving our country and also for telling us about it. I know it's not always easy to talk about it. When you think about your children, your grandchildren, you're a great-grandfather, there are a few generations of your family that wouldn't be here if some of those what-ifs had gone the other way in your story. What do you want us to know and think about when we hear your story and we think about World War II?
I think World War II, the people that were in World War II came home to people here that appreciated what we'd done and everything, and I think it's a real shame that they didn't do that in the other so-called wars that we had from the Vietnam and the Korean War. It's just totally amazing. But to see the people now, and even back on this trip back to Washington, when we landed in Baltimore, here were people greeting us there. I mean, it just, I don't know how this word has got around, but it's like a new deal, what's happening. Resurrection of thanking the people that were in the service.
Does it make you feel like you did something that mattered?
It certainly does. It's just hard to believe that the people now, and even in Baltimore, my God, they go through there in lines and people come up to you, see with your jacket or your hat, come up and the people in Washington, D.C., same deal. I don't know how many were in Fresno when we came home, and we were 2.5 hours late. And to see this, the bagpipes and the people lined up, and going through this line and all these sailors there standing there, and I got down to the end, I couldn't believe it. Here my whole family was there, from my grandsons, other people that I knew and everything, and they had waited 2.5, 3 hours too. I just couldn't believe it.
I don't know if this is an easy one to answer or not, but I've just heard you tell your story, and from, you know, being on the Arizona for a brief while and getting off before it met its fate to leaving that berth near Ford Island that the Utah inherited and sank, to surviving the sinking of your own ship and all those close calls. How do you account for that? How do you figure out why you and why you're still here and enjoying life?
Well, I think the good Lord looked after me. I tell you, there was a lot of times that I prayed out there when I was at sea. I don't know why I was picked to survive. And I just can't believe it. I mean, because there have been so many. There was other close calls would happen aboard ship a lot of times. I had one deal that a plane crashed, and I crawled under the turret of this big gun, and about that far, this plane crashed right into this thing. And so there's just so many things. A friend of mine, I'm standing one, we were having night carrier landings one time, and I'm standing talking to him, and was off of Honolulu out of Pearl Harbor. Prior to the war, we're training program, or people night flying and night carrier landings, and a plane comes in and busted one of the, what we call the cross-deck pennants that stops the planes, and it whipped around. I'd just been talking to him, and I turned around, and I hadn't got 10 yards away from him, and this plane crashed or busted this barrier cable or cross-deck pennant and hit him and took his leg off. We had a little net off the side of the ship like this, and it was dark, and they just heard somebody moaning and found him here in the net. But he was fortunate, he lost a leg. But I mean, there are just so many things that crashes. Another time a plane chased me in the flight deck that was coming in for a landing. I was up on the flight deck, and I just bailed out over the side into where the gun turrets were down there. Knocked a guy flat down there, and I just head first. And this plane here, one wing was in the deck, flight deck, and the other one on top one of the guns down there. Just so many things that happened. Like I say, the good Lord had to be looking out for me.
And that hasn't stopped. Just a few more questions for 95-year-old Gordon Scott in light of this unexpected discovery of his ship nearly 76 years after she sank. You're in good shape, and you're of sound mind, Gordon, so how about this hypothetical for you? And I do imagine there are going to be more images and video of the wreckage to be released in the days and weeks ahead.
But if Paul Allen came over here to the Veterans Home of California in Fresno to pay Gordon Scott a visit, he said, "Gordon, you're one of the last survivors of the USS Lexington. Would you like to come out to the Coral Sea with us on our ship and watch on our monitors as we send that submersible back down? Would you do it?"
Yes, I sure would. I tell you, that's one of the things I'll tell you that I've always wanted to be able to take a ship that could hit all the islands that we hit throughout this period of time. That would be amazing, too.
Well, and that's something to think about, that as this research vessel, the RV Petrel, is sending its submersible down, it's probably resting on the very same spot of ocean where you guys were sunk.
That's right. I just can't, just it's just unbelievable.
And as it was with last year's finding of the USS Indianapolis wreckage, every precaution will be taken to avoid disturbing the remains of any sailors who could still be down there. And that sensitivity goes all the way back to what happened to that other ship that you were assigned to for a brief period of time, the USS Arizona, where it rests in Pearl Harbor.
They went in and tried to recover some of the bodies, and several of the people were killed with explosions from the cutting torches that we were using underwater, and the families petitioned the Navy to leave the people entombed in the Arizona, which they still are, which I thought was great. There's no point in, I don't know of anybody that's entombed there, because they all had a chance to get off of the ship. They might have lost some, but I don't know of any.
Well, so my other question, and I just wanted to couch it that way, because I understand this may be of a trivial nature. If you were piloting that little remote control undersea vehicle and could search the whole ship, is there some part of the ship that you would want to steer it toward, or something that's still on the ship 2 miles deep that you would want to go look for?
Well, I'd like to see the after part of the ship. I was involved in the arresting gear that stopped the planes when they came in for landings, and we were in the after part of the ship, and my shop was right underneath the flight deck of the carrier. Yes, I would. That'd be great.
You didn't leave anything behind in your locker, did you?
Yes, I left everything in my locker. Several times I thought of going down below deck, going back and getting stuff out of my locker that I had in there, but I never did. I stayed up on top of the flight deck for a long time. Like I say, it started at 11, and that was at 5:18 that night. and I never went down below. I was one of the ones that was lucky that didn't get sent down on a deal and fighting the fires within the internal part of the ship.
So what's still down there in that locker, 2 miles deep under the Coral Sea?
Well, so very definitely some clothing, but I did have a folder and a binder there with pictures and everything that I'd had for years. But it wasn't, I didn't have a lot in it, but probably that was the most important thing to me. Some of the people that I had that, in pictures and everything they had there. There was one deal right underneath the flight deck that was kind of like a general store. They had all kinds of stuff in there you could buy through normal times aboard ship and everything. And there was a lot of money involved. I did have some money in within my locker, but it wasn't a large amount. But they did have large amounts of money within the ship that could still be there wherever it is. But there'd be no point in trying to get it.
No, and this program reminds us every time that there are things more valuable than money. There are things money can't buy, like the liberties we enjoy in this country, paid for in full by the selfless sacrifice of our men and women in uniform, including 216 who died while serving on the USS Lexington on May 8, 1942. If you pull up Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook or go to hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find a video of Gordon Scott watching the footage sent back from the ocean floor, looking at images of the ship he served on 76 years after he plunged off of her deck into the waters of the Coral Sea. We can all follow Gordon's lead and thank Paul Allen and his team for bringing this important piece of our military history back to the forefront. And we're going to make sure to let Mr. Allen's team know about Gordon and his story. That's all the time we have on Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.